Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 14, delivered on October 4, 2018. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates and Risk.
Today, interest rates and risk. As you can see in that yield curve right there, we have a rising interest rate environment, significantly more at the long maturities than at the short maturities. Here's a quick question. Okay, interest rates are rising. Now, these are base interest rates that sort of form a substrate for other interest rates. And I'll talk about different base interest rates that banks and other lending institutions and investors use. Treasuries of all kinds are sort of like a good base. Other ones that you might see are these rates called the LIBORs, the London Interbank Offer Rates. There are other ones, the prime bank rate or the prime rate, the federal funds rate's another one. And I'll talk about those in a minute. But clearly these interest rates are going up at the base, which would push other interest rates up as well. So we can expect, for example, that you, sir, have decided that it's time for you to settle down. You're going to buy your own place to live, a double-wide house trailer on the south side of Decatur with one of those really nice skirts that goes around it, so that kind of helps keep the vermin out, the possums and all that, except that you have a hole where they can come in, and that's a trap that kills them, so you have barbecue for the weekend for the family. Life is good. You graduated from ISU. Okay. Now, interest rates are, you're thinking about buying one of those trailers. You, sir, are also thinking about buying a nice place, a modest house, let's say. And you, madam, are also considering buying a house. You're thinking of this. Interest rates obviously are going up. Is this going to make you and other people not borrow? Or how is this going to affect your decision to get that dream home or hovel, in your case? How is that going to affect your decision? Go ahead.
The cost of borrowing would be a lot more expensive.
So what are you going to do?
So you're not going to buy.
Actually, you're going to do exactly the opposite of that. You're going to buy. Why are you going to get those? Why are you going to say yes? I thank you, by the way, for that. Why are you going to say yes, yes, yes? I want that house. I want that nice little condo. I want that double-wide trailer. Why are you going to do that in a row? Yeah, go.
So you
don't
get a lower rate.
Yahtzee, yes. You're moving in front of what you see as a hurricane in front. See, if you know that interest rates are going up, what that does is that actually causes a spike in borrowing now. Well, interest rates are going up. The economy is going to go to hell immediately. No, it won't. Actually, you'll have this borrowing activity, trying to get in front of those rising interest rates. It seems like it's a perverse phenomenon, but it's actually, if prices are rising, you tend to see this quick movement toward activity. Economic activity actually has a brief flare-up because basically it's going to be a bad time very soon. If I'm trying to not harass people. Yes, I am. Why not? Okay, if you, madam, are like me, you love spam. maple flavor, bacon flavor, spam with cheese, spam without cheese, anything you can, spam. If you hear that spam prices are going up, you will run to the store and buy spam now. You will hoard it. And that's an interesting effect of any in the wake of a recession. And it's kind of interesting, too, because you'll have all these pundits saying, and politicians, well, the economy's doing good. Look, we had activity. Actually, the economy in the months leading up to a very bad time will tend to look better than it should. You're going to have a major surgery that will leave you on your back for 6 months. That happens next week. Are you going to say, no, no parties for me? No, you are going to party like it's 1999. That's the whole idea, is keep an eye on an economic flare-up. That could be the very first sign that markets are aware that it's about to get bad, and they are moving, they're leaning into activity beforehand. Corporate bond issues will tend to spike during this time. Corporations selling new debt paper so that they get lower coupon rates than they would later on. Consumers, households borrowing to buy houses. That's another one that will happen. Interestingly, there are also companies getting short-term credit lines at lower interest rates. And also, the other side of that is that the people who save, households, investors who save money, they tend to hold off putting money into their investments for a while because they figure that they can get a higher rate if they wait. If you have, let's say, $10,000, and you could put your money into a 3-year CD right now, or you could wait 6 months when CD rates are higher, what would you do? Would you put the money in now, or would you wait 6 months to put it in? Wouldn't you wait? You would wait simply because you know you could get a better rate later. So we'll see investment lending tend to go down at the same time the demand for borrowed funds will go up. That in itself begins to cause interest rates to go up in it because the supply of the lendable funds is going down at the same time that the demand for lendable funds is going up. It actually all fits together kind of logically like a puzzle. It's just basic economics and finance. Now let me go through. I talked about interest rates and what are the what last time I got to the point where essentially, every interest rate at its bottoming out point, at its bottom, has a risk-free rate in it. Any interest rate that you want to talk about has in it a baseline rate, which is a composite of two rates. The real rate, driven by supply and demand on funds, plus the expected inflation premium. And I talked a lot about that the last time. That expected inflation premium can be a nasty sort of thing because once that embeds, it's not easy to shake it out. And so you can have a government running inflationary monetary policy for years, and ultimately when they finally stop, the markets don't believe them, expected inflation premium stays high. So interest rates stay high because of that for a while. In the early 1980s, even though the Fed had finally gotten around, had gotten a chairman who crushed the money supply, which drove the real rate up, markets didn't believe that inflation was over. They didn't believe that the Fed was really going to do it this time. The Fed had been promising for years to do this. So the market said, yeah, sure, we're just going to keep jacking up the expected inflation premium. And it was only after a long period of time, 2-3 years, that the markets began to believe that the Fed was serious. The real rate stayed high, but finally this expected inflation premium began to slip back down. That's something that we have wanted to, we got the experience from that. And we've learned since then, don't lie to the markets for too long. If you just keep increasing the money supply faster than the real growth rate of the economy, eventually the markets are going to stop believing you when you say we're going to claw back that liquidity. There's an exception. Sometimes an economy, you can print way too much money. We saw this in China. China in the early 1990s, well, it was after Mao Zedong. He was an ideologue. He was, to a large extent, he was a moron about economics. But then he began to be replaced with more Western-trained, more practical communist leaders after his time. Who began to understand that they were going to have to get China to grow. China was a massive, massive land, massive resources, including insane amounts of human capital and labor. In a situation like that, you can actually pour money in at an insane rate and not get inflation, at least not for many, many years, because essentially you're picking up a lot of slack that had been there for a very long time. That happened in the U.S. economy to a much smaller extent. In 2009, the Fed started cranking up the money supply insanely, and there were a lot who said, well, this is going to create an inflation, and more importantly, an expectation of inflation. It didn't, again, because we had actually had a very low production economy for the first years of the 21st century. Industrial production, industrial productivity, all of those metrics were actually in terrible shape from 2001 through 2008. And the Fed itself had been making the problem much worse because it wasn't increasing the money supply enough for a number of years. And ultimately, so when we had that crash in 2008, the Fed started printing money like hand over fist, and it didn't create any inflation pressure and no inflation expectation, simply because there was all of that slack that had been building in the economy, so you could pour money into that pit and not create a problem. Now we're at the other end of it, though. The Fed knows, okay, we've printed long enough. Markets are getting a little bit skittish here. Now, going on to the next one. Here's the one. Plus. R sub F plus. And there is this enormous thing called the risk premium. See if I can find it. Madam, are you familiar with zombies? You are. Darn. Did you watch Zombieland?
Yeah.
Okay. You remember the rules? Double tap, cardio, don't go into a public restroom. Those are the, you know, basics.
Yeah.
Surviving a zombie apocalypse. Now, madam. Are you familiar with vampires?
Somewhat.
Okay, good. Now, you do understand that the rules he's going to follow for zombies are not going to be the rules you follow for vampires, right? Okay, a zombie comes up to you and you hold a cross at it. It's just going to eat your brain. You do that to a vampire, hold up garlic. And the vampire runs. You hold up garlic, flavor for my brains. You think, what the hell? The thing is that there are different factors that affect different kinds of interest rates. Now, there are some that are pretty much common to all interest rates. Like the longer you borrow money for, the riskier the interest rate has to, the greater risk the interest rate has to represent. And I'll get to that in a minute. But there are some that are unique or are more or less. For example, the first one is what we call the default premium. The default premium is some extra that is charged for the risk that the borrower is not going to pay back some or all of what is borrowed. A default premium, so for example, do you have a credit card?
Two.
Do you pay your bill? Well, I know, right? You know, that might be, you know, a couple of years from now for me, you know, whenever. try this one. Madam, do you have a car?
Yes.
Do you have a car loan?
Yes.
Okay. Now, what happens if you don't pay that car loan? That sucks for the bank, right? But why doesn't it suck as much for the bank compared to a credit card? What are they going to do if you don't pay your bill?
They're going to come
after. Yeah, those idiots in those black suits in the middle of the night come in, and the repo guys, and they repo your car. They take it back away from you. In other words, there's an asset backing that loan. So the risk of default, it's there, but it's not as bad as the risk on a credit card. You, sir, are someday going to own a house. Now, if you don't pay for that house, they're going to take that house away from you, right? And you're going to hear the bank's crocodile say, well, we had to take that. We took a loss on that. Actually, they don't. Because most people don't know that every payment contains an insurance premium. They pay the actual you pay. In case you default, the spread between what the bank gets for the house and what the bank is owed on the house is covered by that insurance premium you paid for. So there's really hardly any risk at all in a mortgage, in a home mortgage, or at least a primary home mortgage. Most people don't realize banks cry, well, this house, they defaulted, they owed $150,000, and the house is only worth $120,000, so we lost $30,000, boo-hoo. No, they didn't. That was covered by an insurance policy called MAGIC, Mortgage Assurance Guarantee Corporation. And you poor son of a bitch, the one that kicked out of the house, you are the one who paid the payments on that insurance premium, insurance policy. Okay, now, the government. I've talked about this before, I'm pretty sure. Will the government ever default on something? Government borrows money from you. I'm the government. And you lend me money. Am I ever going to default, not pay you? No. Because I will never. See, suppose I don't have the money to pay you. You know what I'll do? I'll just print more money and pay you. You're saying, wait a minute, isn't that kind of funny? Yeah, but it works. Oh, what happens if the printing press is broken? Ah, well, we'll just attack another country, lie about why we attack them and take all their stuff. We do that all the time. We've been doing that all through history. You see, we are not going to not pay you. You lend us money, we'll pay you back. We'll take care of you. Okay? There is zero default premium on a government debt instrument. There is zero. There is no default premium. Now, if it's a corporation, here's where it gets a little interesting. Because if it's a AAA, say it's a corporation that has AAA, no, go ahead.
Will Illinois ever default on its debt?
We're getting to that sad thing here in a minute, actually. As a matter of fact, there is something called the Illinois premium. Believe it or not, any debt instrument, sovereign debt instrument from Illinois, whether it's from a city or a township or the state, it actually carries a punch of, I think it's about 35 basis points, just because it's Illinois. It's called the Illinois Premium. I'm glad you brought that up because, you see, there are it's really kind of unfair to Illinois. Illinois, yes, does have major, major financial problems. And there is a possibility that we could see a default on some munis in Illinois. But Illinois is most decidedly not unique in that regard. I mean, you've got a number of states that are in serious trouble financially that could very well default, or cities within those states could default. It's not one political party or another. It's just, in some states, it's just a matter of insane amounts of spending, like Illinois. In other states, it's just insane tax cuts, like Wisconsin. It's just essentially what it is. It's just pure irresponsibility. It's ideology overrunning common sense. Okay, Illinois, do we have the money to pay for all of this wonderful stuff for Chicago? No, we don't. So let's do it anyway and borrow. Okay, Wisconsin, your school system sucks. It needs probably several $1 billion to put it back together. Your bridges and roads are falling down. So is it really a good idea for you to cut taxes low to please the Koch brothers? Well, no. Okay, let's cut taxes then. You see, it's not one side or the other. It's just irresponsibility, for God's sake. And we have other states. Florida is another state. You've got states, Michigan. There's a crater that won't ever be filled. Detroit, you understand. Do you know that in your yard, there are all these creatures who are dedicated evolutionarily to ruining a good lawn landscape? Did you know that? I thought moles were a real problem. So I had this guy, he's an expert. There were these pits in the ground, and there were these cracks splitting open. You know, my cats were going to fall in. I said, I've got moles. He said, them ain't moles. Them are voles. Voles? Voles. And then he comes out there, and he starts taking these punches. And these big animals come popping out of the ground. They're actually pretty good if you get a couple of them together on a grill. Where the hell was I? Okay. Okay, so in other words, a corporate AAA bond would have a very low risk of default, so its default premium would be quite small. In other words, the coupon on a corporate bond that was AAA would be not all that far above a treasury bond of the same maturity. But when you get the rating goes down, and this is why it gets so upsetting for companies, they don't want their ratings to go down because as the rating goes down, that means the market is going to put a higher and higher default premium on that corporate debt. So I had AAA corporate debt, and suddenly Standard & Poor's and Fitch and Moody all say, well, you're now downgraded. That means that my next borrowing, I'm going to have to pay a higher coupon rate because there's going to be a higher default premium on it. Now, realistically, though, if you've got something that's like a double A or a single A, there's really not that much chance that it's going to default. Not soon, though. Let me give you an interesting example. In my international work, you've got a country like, for example, Panama. Panama is just like a magnet for investment. You go down there, it looks like there are skyscrapers going up literally every week. There's another skyscraper. There are these massive tiers of highway overpasses and underpasses being built throughout the city and on the periphery. The Panama Canal is going to be dug out and expanded. Wow, this is a lot of money. Their bonds, interestingly enough, are running government bonds in Panama are running at 4.5% against the benchmark of the same length, 30 years, of a U.S. Treasury at 3%. So in other words, you're talking about, in that case, a default premium for Panama versus U.S. of 1.5%. That's actually not... I, 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 obviously, that was impressive to me because you're talking about a Central American country. Back in my time, you know, I was down there to kill people back many years ago, and now it's turned into the, like, the Mecca of Central America. Chinese, Russians, Saudis are pouring money in. Good news. And oddly enough, you've got Colombia to the south, you got Costa Rica, you got Guatemala, Nicaragua, all burning in hell. So that was impressive. Now, let's reel over to West Africa. I teach these people from the Ministries of Finance, Economic Development, Oil and Gas, from some West African countries. One of those countries, Ghana, just issued a 15-year note last year. The World Bank, in all of its blessed glory. Now, understand, Standard & Poor's Global puts a Ghana sovereign debt, at a triple B. That is not, I mean, you're talking about, that's not bad, that's investment grade. So what was the coupon rate that the wonderful World Bank set for Ghana to pay on the money that it borrowed, $750 million? 19.5%. Holy crap. I said, you do realize there is no freaking way you should have had a default premium that high. Well, what do we do about it? Well, next time, let's find some Chinese, Russian, and Saudi investors, and let's get you right with some real money instead of this kind of con game. Well, you're a very risky country. Standard & Poor's Global doesn't think you are. I'm sure we can find them a better rate premium. In other words, you see, if you got a 3% baseline for a U.S. Oh, actually, it wouldn't even be that high. This was a 15, so it'd probably be more like about 2.7% baseline for a 15-year U.S. debt. And then you're talking about, which would be AAA, and then you've got a Ghana debt, triple B, at 19.5%. You're talking about a default premium that's just absolutely wrong. Why was that? Because there was only one investor, the World Bank. They didn't let anyone else come in. And if they had let others come in, obviously the price of the debt would have been bid up, the yield would have been bid down there as a consequence, and you would have had a lower default premium as a result. I'm talking above you. You'll come to my level. Trust me. You're good. You know how to do this. The next one is the maturity premium. The maturity premium. Yeah, go ahead.
Is that the, our credit score, is that like when it goes up, that means you're
going to
be
better? Yeah. Actually, you know, I'm glad you brought that up. Credit scores are the people equivalent of bond ratings. So, yeah, I mean, it's like you have a credit score. Your credit score, you look like a very responsible person. You work at a great place. I know where you work. It was awesome. It was two double cheddar Culver's burgers. I mean, pickles only.
Are you being serious?
And she brought them out to me. They told me to pull forward. They said, pull forward, fat boy. And I pulled forward, and she brought them out, and it was awesome. I mean, those burgers, I mean, I was nauseous after the second one. Anyway, what the hell? What was I talking? Oh, credit score. No, I mean, don't get to my age. Just have them put you in a home. Credit scores, as they go up, you're obviously going to get better lending possibilities. You won't have to go to Earl's House of Cash for money. Yeah, and that's one of the things also is that these credit scores, oddly, there are some odd, weird things that happen that they're actually the same kinds of things that happen with corporate debt. Did you know that if you pay off, you got something, a car loan, you know if you pay it off early, you actually have your credit rating go down? Why? It's exactly the same reason as a corporation gets punished. You did an early call. the bank was expecting to get a cash flow at a specific interest rate for a specific amount of time, you pulled the rug out from under them. You changed the cash flow pattern on them. That's risk. So they smack your ass for that. Next time, we're not going to trust you. You said you'd pay this for 5 years. You paid it off in 3 years. Bad consumer. Bad consumer. And people are, well, that's a bullshit thing, man. No, not really. It's actually just corporate policies. And so what we want to do is we want to keep our eye on what really is a ripoff and what is just normal. Look, the maturity premium is a nasty thing because it cuts both ways. Interest rates go up or interest rates go down, you're hurt. Madam, you are a consumer. You have borrowed money on a home loan from me. I am a banker. I gave you, in good faith, a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage at 6%. In other words, you issued paper to me, 30-year paper to me, promising to pay me 6% on, let's say that you went hog wild and bought a $200,000 house. Okay, now, we're great. You come in every month to make your payment, and I'm the bank president. Hi there, borrower. And you say, hi there, lender. And we exchange niceties about our families, which we don't really care about each other's families, but we do that anyway. Now, suppose in 3 years, interest rates on mortgages slide down to, let's say, 4%. What are you going to do? You're going to keep paying me 6% interest on the mortgage, or are you going to refi? You're going to refi. You are going to pull the... See, I was expecting to get a cash flow from you for 30 years at 6%. What did you do when interest rates went to 4%? You took me to the cleaners. You borrowed the money at 4% and paid me off. So when I get that money back, I have to lend it out at the prevailing rate of 4%. My expectation of 6% for 30 years is gone. So in other words, I face downside interest rate risk as a lender. If interest rates fall, there's going to be refis all over the place. Okay? In corporate America, if interest rates fall, corporations are just going to go out and sell new debt at a lower coupon rate and pay off the higher coupon rate if they have callables. Okay, so that... So I've got risk on the downside. Now, here's the other thing. Did you know that the average consumer keeps a house for about 7 years, average household? Then they move on. Look, think about it this way. You bought your first house, and then you had a couple of kids, and then your brother, Alec, moves back in, and he starts doing something late at night in your garage, and he won't let you, don't come in, man! And he comes out with this mask on. And then you have your husband's ex shows up with the 5 kids they had. We're talking about America here. You got a problem with America? Trust me, it gets so weird. You know, one day you wake up, how the hell did I get all these people in my house? And where are my cats? Okay, you're going to have to move on, okay? That's a normal, about 7 years to hold, and then you sell that house, pay off the mortgage, and move on. I expect that, okay? I'm the banker. But what happens if interest rates start skyrocketing? 6% you're paying, suddenly interest rates are 10%, 12% on mortgages. You're going to sell your house and refi, buy a new house? No, you're going to stay there. You're going to dig underground places for the kids to live. You're going to put a shed out back. You'll buy it at Home Depot. You know, one of those things, they're not bad. There was this one I was looking at. It actually has 2 rooms in it. Okay, you're going to find ways to keep that house. I was expecting you to pay off in 7 years. I'd love to have you pay off because mortgage rates are higher now. You give me that money back, I can lend it at a higher rate. You're not going to do that. You're going to hold on. So if interest rates go up, I'm screwed. Either way, as the length of a mortgage or a loan of any kind goes farther, there is a higher probability that interest rates are going to go down or up, either of which hurts me. So in other words, the maturity premium actually is just an extra amount that's charged the longer the loan is. You see those maturity premiums every day when I show you the yield curves. Those are maturity premiums. You go from 1, 3, 5, 7, 10, 15, 20, 30. As the interest rate goes up, that's the maturity premium. Just it's more for longer debt. So, in other words, interestingly enough, you would have a 30-year corporate bond and a 30-year treasury have the same maturity premium. Also, interestingly enough, the U.S. Treasuries, the only risk premium they carry is the maturity premium. So in other words, a 30-year treasury doesn't have a default premium because it's not going to default. It doesn't have this last one I'm going to talk about. The only one it has is this core right here, this maturity premium right there. And in fact, I can even show you that like this. It's actually that pretty easy. I should have just left this up. Look. Let me get just the current month so that I don't have this massive data here. Okay, look. See this right here? Do you see that? A 1 month annualized, that has nothing in it. No default premium, no maturity premium, no liquidity premium. You see from here, a 10-year has a 1 basis point maturity premium. That's the only thing that could make the 10-year higher than the perfect, almost instantaneous. That is a 100 basis point maturity premium. And then for the 20-year, if you look at the 20-year versus the 10-year, there's an extra 9 basis points on it. And if you look at the 20-year versus the 30-year, there is an extra 6 basis points on it. So in other words, all you're seeing as interest rates go up on something on debt instruments that are all otherwise identical, the only thing that could be making that happen is a maturity premium. So if we were to look at the 1 month versus the 30-year, 30 years, the markets are saying, is 115 basis points of risk on interest rates. The maturity premium is nothing but the risk of interest rates changing. And interestingly enough, as the yield curve flattens, notice here, let me do something. Go. From the first of the year, what is that? 152 basis points at the first of the year. Now it is, 106 basis points. So you see that the maturity premium has actually fallen substantially, meaning that there is less risk of interest rate volatility now than there was at the beginning of the year. Simply that means that once you get into a recessionary environment, interest rates are going to sort of settle and they're not going to move very far in any direction. They don't dare move very far in any direction. Now, liquidity premium, Arcibel. This is the risk that you can't get rid of debt that you have. I lend you money for a house, sir. You know that I'm the bank. I won't have that loan for more than about an hour before I sell it. to the what are called the secondary to a secondary mortgage market. We get rid. I don't want to keep debt. A bank actually is no. Most banks are no longer in the business of lending money. They are actually in the business of servicing loans. They get rid of the loan as fast as they can, if they can get rid of it, because they don't want to have the risk of lending money. They want to just be bankers. We take your payments, we send them to where they go. We take your checking, your money into your checking account, and we keep it for you so that you can get it out whenever you want. That's all the banks are anymore. The same is true in student loans. Do any of you still get your student loans from banks, or do you get them directly from the government now? It used to be that you went to banks to get them. Banks dump those student loans within minutes. They don't want student loans. They sold them to a secondary mortgage, secondary market for student loans. These are not small secondary markets. The one for home mortgages, Ginnie Mae. There's also Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. These are, essentially, they constitute trillions of dollars. What happens is, you, madam, get a loan for a house. You the same day, a few of you, all over the country. Those loans are actually all sent to sold immediately. Well, they bundle them up. Banks hold loans for a few hours or a day or two, and then they bundle them up, and then they sell them off to Ginnie Mae. Ginnie Mae turns those into a giant super bond backed by the loans. But it's even more complicated than that, because what they'll do is they'll carve that loan, those loans up. There's the payments on the principal. There's the payments part of the payment on the interest. There's those loans that'll prepay, this, that, and the other thing, early payment loans. They will divide it up into investment packages, super bonds called Ginnie Mae's, Fannie Mae's, Freddie Mac's, and all those kinds of things. And then investors of enormous proportions will buy those. In other words, they become the final lender. The banks were just essentially a quickie lender before it went to the real money. Where is that real money coming from? We're talking about money on the order of billions of dollars. I mean, hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars. Well, it's the same place everything else comes from. The places where we sent our money to get cheap toasters. And the places we sent money to get cheap oil. The places we sent money to get cheap goods and services. That is where that money comes from. And it purchases these massive super bonds. But it's even worse than that. Because then you can write derivatives off those. CDOs, collateralized debt obligations. CMOs, collateralized mortgage obligations. They're essentially derivatives that are backed by the risk profile of the super bonds or the mini bonds in some cases. And then those things are bought as risk hedging instruments and speculation instruments by banks, the ones who got rid of the loans, and now they buy this stuff back. And then those things go south very fast in a bad time. Like in 2008, the collateralized debt obligation derivatives that were backed by these super bonds and all kinds of other debt, those things all crashed. They were owned by banks, trust funds, insurance companies all over the world. Those CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, CMOs, collateralized mortgage obligations, just crashed. They're sitting on the balance sheets of financial institutions all over the world. They're zombies. They're dead. They'll never come back to life. And the banks and other institutions just sit there, have them on the books. Nothing you can do about it. How much are we talking about in notional value on the books of financial institutions around the world just from the toxic waste of 2008? About $64 trillion. What's going to happen during this crash? That one will look like a joke, because after the crash, those banks and all those traders and players and hedgers and speculators waited a few years, and then they started crying to Congress and to the president, and so they said, oh, we'll let off the screws. You can go back to what you were doing. This time, the crash will probably be on the order of $500 to $650 trillion, enough to bring down the world economy. So let's hope that doesn't happen. Here's the problem, though. There are some kinds of debt that you can't get rid of. Like, for example, car loans are actually, banks have would have a hard time selling those off to a player, to another investor. If you guys all borrow for cars, those loans sit in the bank. Now, a bank might really not want to keep those loans because they represent a risk profile the bank might not want. But it would be hard to find a way to standardize a package of car loans. Mortgage loans are really standard. 30 years. Here's the interest rate. Here's your payment. Here's this this part that goes for this. Here's this part that goes for that. Here are the extra fees, the banking fees. They're really standardized instruments. But car loans don't have that standardization. So, okay. Do you remember when you were a kid? Do you remember bubbles?
I do.
Okay, do you remember how sometimes bubbles would stick together? They go,
yeah.
And then you'd have this double thing. You know, the kids on my street were rather crude. They say, look, it's a double bubble. But okay, they fit. Now, you're over there. God, why did he shut up? Okay, now, I want you to imagine that you're all grown up, and now you don't play with bubbles anymore. You play with slime and silly putty. Now, have you ever tried to put slime and silly putty together? It doesn't work. I tried it, believe me. I tried it several times. And bubbles, mortgages. Silly putty and slime, car loans. You've got a silly putty Kia. You've got a slimy Prius. Really, Prius? The loans don't have, exactly. Yours is a four-year. Yours is a six-year. You have a higher credit rating than you do. You paid a higher interest rate than you. You see how they don't fit together so that you can't create uniform packages of them. That's why they can't be unloaded. So there would be more of a liquidity premium. You would have to, the bank would actually have to pay another institution to dump these. Think about it this way. You, madam, are a very wealthy, highly respectable person. You went to a good school. You have a very good family. You need to borrow money from this lady right here. Now, you're going to have your attorneys write up a wherefore thou art and all this. And it will be signed, I will pay back this money in 1 year. Okay? Now, you're going to charge an interest rate. Let's say 6%. Now, and if you really need to get rid of that, you could probably sell it to someone else for almost the face value of it. Okay? Very little liquidity premium. Now, however, I come to you. You are walking down the street of Chicago one day. It's 30 years from now. And they're sitting in a corner on Monroe is this old geezer.
Yeah, I'll be damned. I taught you 30 years ago. Illinois State. I'm Professor Z. Yeah. I need to borrow some money. I got some toilet paper in my pocket here. I'll write I owe you. How much percent? You see, because you need to get rid of this promissory note, who's going to buy it from you? You're going to charge me a higher rate, not just because I'm a damn big risk, but because you can't get rid of this like you could hers. You can't sell my promissory note. So I'm just going, how much do you want? I heard you're lending her money at 6%. How much do you want from me? Go on, you know, tell me. Wait. That tube in my kidney, it's leaking here. There. You know you're going to charge me more than 6%, not just because of default risk, but because you're going to be stuck with it. You can't get rid of that. That's liquidity premium. Let me give you a real example. When I was a penny stockbroker, you see, we would have these stocks that someone would put in a sell order for 500 shares of some miserable pink sheet stock. And how am I going to, it would take me weeks, maybe months, to find someone who would match that order on the other side with a buy for that dog of a company.
So in other words, when I would say, well, the price of this stock is $1.25 per share, I'm going to say I'm going to pay you $1 per share. And they say, what the hell? And I say, because it is going to be so hard for me to unload this stock. That's liquidity premium. I'm dropping the price, raises the yield on it for me because I'm facing a risk that I will not be able to get rid of that stock for weeks or months. In a couple of cases, I was stuck permanently with stock because I couldn't unload it. And every time you have that experience, what it does is it makes you do a lower bid. Okay, it's saying $1.25. Well, last year I did $1 and I got screwed because I still have that stock. This time I'm going to pay you 80 cents for it if you want to sell it to me. You see, I'm driving the price down, drives my expected yield up. That's pure liquidity premium on it. So there are the three pieces. You put those together, it's like a composite that happens over time. Every interest rate has some combination of these. The one that is interesting, and it's used am I really that bad off that I can't oh, there it is. Okay. Here's an interesting one. We can take corporate debt. Now, understand the corporate debt. Suppose that you had what's a 10-year? The 10-year is 3.05. 10-year government is 3.05%. Suppose that I see that the 10-year AAA corporate is 3.28%. The only difference between the AAA corporate and the government, they would have the same maturity premium because they're both 10 years. Both of them would be really easy to unload. You could call your broker and sell either of those in a second. Okay? The only difference between them would be the default premium. The government wouldn't have one. The AAA would. So this difference right here, which is 23 basis points, is the default premium on AAA 10-year. It'd have to be, because there would be no other difference between the two. Yeah. Yahtzee. Yeah. And then I could actually do it for triple B. I could do it for any credit rating to see what the default premium is on that particular quality of debt. Like, remember when I told you that Panama did 15-year notes? Was it 15? No, they were the 30-year. They were 30 years at 4.5%. The U.S., 30-year sovereign debt, 30-year was 3%. So the difference between those would be purely the default premium on Panamanian debt. That's all it would be in 150 basis points. And that's what just floored me about the Ghana debt, was that a 15-year U.S. Treasury note, 15 years, that at the time was running at about it was around 2.80%. And they charged 19.5%. They were saying that the default premium was about 17% on Ghana debt. Now, sure, it's a little risky. It was triple B rated. But triple B should not create a default premium anywhere near that. So it was just basically a screw over. And I'll show you more about it if you're interested in the next couple of, after the midterm. You'll see that these kinds of tricks, you can find ways to get out from under these. And one of the big things right now, and
I'm hoping Illinois State will take my lead, and we're going to begin to get some finance people, students, MBAs, undergrads involved so that we can start finding better markets for these. Now, there was one more thing that I should bring up here. It's munis, municipals. Municipals are just government debt, but they have a special feature. Municipals are tax exempt, your coupon payments. So if you borrow money, if you lend money to, you lend me, a corporation, money, when I pay you the interest on that, that's taxable. You lend me $1,000. I pay you $80 a year. That $80 is taxable. Municipal debt, it's tax-free. The coupons are. That's why municipal interest rates are lower than corporate interest rates, adjusting for that tax effect. An investor won't need as much of a return because they don't pay taxes on munis. And so that helps, that's to encourage investors to put money into the municipal securities. And it encourages especially, but the problem is that when municipals default, they cause the markets to jack up the default premium on all municipal debt. The first one in modern times, and it was a dramatic one. No one ever thought about munis defaulting. It was in Cleveland, Ohio, a muni defaulted. It just shocked the hell out of her. A muni defaulted. So instantly, the default premium on all municipals that were being issued just popped. We never thought of it. Now we think of it. So then, does anyone know munis that have defaulted recently in your time, in that last few years? Detroit. Have you ever been in Detroit? Good. Don't. Seriously. I drove through Detroit a couple of times. I was lucky. I still had my hubcaps. Two of them. It is rough there. It's like a third world country in some places. It's just destroyed because of irresponsibility of the politicians in Michigan and in Detroit itself. Corruption, mismanagement, stupidity, you name it. They all work together to create a disaster. So, muni defaults. Pop. We are scared. The markets are very worried about the situation in Illinois. So if it's anything in Illinois that's a muni, it's going to have the Illinois premium, a little extra nudge up here just to reflect the greater risk of default on something from Illinois. Ditto for Wisconsin, ditto for Florida, ditto for California, you name it. Probably easily 30 states of the union have some state premium representing a greater or lesser degree of default risk, abnormal, unusual. So all of that's part of this whole mess. And it's like I say all the time, this is your problem, not mine. You're going to have to figure out how to fix all of this. I will see you on Tuesday for a review. That's all I have for you. I thank you.